This is Jeff Blankfort welcoming you to the November 25th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. It's difficult to know where to begin today when speaking about what's been happening in an area that has been much in my mind for the past 45 years. In the summer of 1970, I spent 4.5 months on a photographic assignment in Lebanon and Jordan. It was to document the life struggles and growing resistance movements among Palestinians in the refugee camps created following their expulsion from their homeland, most in 1948, as a price for the new state of Israel, and others in 1967, when Israel conquered the West Bank and expanded to the Jordan River. I would not be back in Lebanon until the fall of 1983, a year after Israel sent 80,000 soldiers across the border on the pretext of destroying the PLO, which had nothing approaching an army. That invasion, now largely forgotten in the West, took the lives of close to 20,000 Lebanese and Palestinian civilians, not including those massacred at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps by a Lebanese Christian militia under the watchful eye and with the support of Israel's occupying army. That October 23rd, not long after I had arrived, I was awakened at 6:15 in the morning by the vibration of what I took to be a huge explosion. The U.S. Marine base, a mile away and next to the Beirut airport, had been destroyed by a massive truck bomb, leaving 241 dead. 15 minutes later, an apartment house not far away, which served as a barracks for the French peacekeeping forces, was turned into a pile of rubble by another truck bomber, with 58 dead. The U.S. and its Western allies claimed, without any proof, that the attacks were organized by Iran and carried out by suicide bombers from Hezbollah, which was then in its infancy as a resistance movement to Israel's occupation. There were, however, amongst almost as many questions raised among Lebanese and some foreign journalists about the circumstances of both attacks as there were about 9/11, questions, like those about 9/11, that have never been satisfactorily answered. But that's not the reason for my bringing up the story. It's simply that in watching the bodies being carried out from the Marine barracks and seeing the corpses being lifted from the rubble of the building that had housed the French troops, I sensed that what I had witnessed was the future of our planet, which is what I told friends upon my return to California. And so it has come to pass. At about 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be going back to Lebanon, which has seen many suicide bombings since, but via Skype, to speak about the subject of ISIS or Daesh, but from a very different perspective than you may have heard yesterday from President Obama and French President François Hollande, or that you will hear or read in our mainstream media. We'll be discussing the implications of NATO member Turkey shooting down a Russian fighter jet yesterday as it was presumably ready to carry out attacks against anti-government forces. I will be speaking with Lebanese American activist Rania Masri, who I've interviewed several times before on Takes on the World. It should come as no surprise that the deadly attacks in Paris, November 13th, have been seized upon by Washington's chicken hawks. One of them, Robert Kagan, as a co-founder of the Project for New American Century, or PNAC, was a major promoter of America's devastating war in Iraq, whose legacy we are dealing with today. He also served as a foreign policy advisor to John McCain during his presidential run, and now, more importantly, he is doing the same for Democratic presidential contender Hillary Clinton. Many of you will remember that part of PNAC's declaration back in 1997 was that what was required to get the American public behind a war to oust Saddam Hussein and establish unchallenged U.S. dominance over the Middle East, with Israel at its side, of course, was a Pearl Harbor-like event. Very conveniently, they got it, with the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Now, 18 years later, having never apologized for what he had helped unleash upon the planet, Kagan is at it again. Writing in last Saturday's Wall Street Journal, Kagan was arguing for aggressive U.S. intervention to oust Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Given his influence on what may be our next president and the likelihood that she may appoint him to a critical foreign policy position, it's important to know what advice Kagan is likely to pass on to her. So here's a taste of it. Addressing his proposed U.S. intervention, Kagan rhetorically asked, what would such an effort look like? Well, first, it would require establishing a safe zone in Syria, providing the millions of would-be refugees still in the country a place to stay, and the hundreds of thousands who have fled to Europe a place to which to return. To establish such a zone, American military officials estimate, would require not only U.S. air power, but ground forces numbering up to 30,000. Once a safe zone was established, many of those troops could be replaced by forces from Europe, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and other Arab states, but the initial force would have to be largely American. In addition, writes Kagan, a further 10,000 to 20,000 U.S. troops will be required to uproot Islamic State from the haven it has created in Syria and to help local forces uproot in Iraq. Many of those troops could be replaced then by NATO and other international forces to hold the territory and provide a safe zone for rebuilding the areas shattered by Islamic State rule. At the same time, says Kagan, an internationally negotiated and blessed process of transition in Syria should take place, ushering the bloodstained Mr. Assad from power and establishing a new provisional government to hold nationwide elections. The heretofore immovable Mr. Assad, he says, would face an entirely new set of military facts on the ground. With the Syrian opposition now backed by U.S. forces and air power, the Syrian Air Force grounded and Russian bombing halted. But how exactly, he doesn't say. Throughout the transition period and probably beyond even the first rounds of election, he goes on, an international peacekeeping force made up of French, Turkish, American, and other NATO forces, as well as Arab troops, would have to remain in Syria until a reasonable level of stability, security, and intersectarian trust was achieved. Amazing, saying that after what we've seen in Iraq. Well, he goes on, is such a plan so unthinkable, he asks? And this is where he gets uglier. In recent years, he complains, the mere mention of U.S. ground troops has been enough to stop any conversation. Americans, or at least the intelligentsia and political class, remain traumatized by Iraq, and all calculations about what to do in Syria have been driven by that trauma, end quote. I must interject here that Clinton advisor Robert Kagan seems to have totally forgotten that the millions of Iraqis still driven by that trauma and the hundreds of thousands of American veterans of Kagan's war who are suffering from the effects of that trauma and committing suicide as a result of it every day. That he can actually write that tripe and get it published in the Wall Street Journal without creating a national scandal is a telling comment on the sorry state of American society. There's more of Kagan. Mr. Obama's advisors, he writes, have been reluctant to present him with options that include even smaller numbers of ground forces, assuming that he would reject them. And Mr. Obama has in turn rejected his advisors' quote, less ambitious proposals on the reasonable grounds that they would be probably insufficient. This dynamic, he writes, has kept the president sneering. Yes, that's right, he writes, sneering at those who have wanted to do more but have been reluctant to be honest about how much more. But it has also allowed him to be comfortable settling for minimal pressure-relieving approaches that he must know cannot succeed, but which at least have the virtue of avoiding the much larger commitment that he has so far refused to make. Whatever one may think of Obama, to describe him as being comfortable with the situation in Syria is mind-blowing, as is Kagan's suggestion that, quote, he may be the first president since the end of World War II who simply doesn't care what happens in Europe. If so, it is again a great irony for Europe, and perhaps a tragic one, he notes, while revealing his contempt for allies across the Atlantic. Quote, he says, having excoriated the U.S. for invading Iraq, he tells us, Europeans play no small part in bringing on the crisis of confidence and conscience that today prevents Americans from doing what may be necessary to meet the Middle Eastern crisis that has Europe reeling, end quote. So now it's all the fault of the Europeans. Again, those were the words of PNAC co-founder Robert Kagan, a fellow of the Brookings Institution, foreign policy advisor to Hillary Clinton, husband of Victoria Nuland, Clinton's former press spokeswoman, and currently Deputy Secretary of State for Europe and Asia, who is active behind the scenes during the Ukrainian coup. Given that Robert's brother Frederick was credited with planning the surge in Iraq, remember that? Well, you have to say they're quite a family. Speaking at the Council of Foreign Relations Friday, the same day as Kagan's op-ed appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Clinton was already demonstrating his influence. In September, she said, I laid out a comprehensive plan to counter Iranian influence across the region and its support for terrorist proxies such as Hezbollah and Hamas. We cannot view Iran and ISIS as separate challenges. Regional politics are too interwoven. Raising the confidence of our Arab partners, says Clinton, and raising the cost to Iran for bad behavior will contribute to a more effective fight against ISIS. And as we work out a broader regional approach, she says, we should, of course, be closely consulting with, envelope please, with Israel, our strongest ally in the Middle East. That's Hillary Clinton, and she's no less frightening to me than Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz. She has the gall to lump ISIS with Iran, Hamas, and Hezbollah, which has been fighting ISIS, while like her mentor Kagan and her principal funder, Israeli media mogul Haim Saban, Clinton plays Israel's tune, ignoring the support that Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey have provided for ISIS while portraying them as U.S. allies. Even Time magazine knows better. Albeit buried deep in an article in its December 7th issue, its writer David Von Drell pointed out that, quote, the Petro-Kingdom has for decades funded the spread of the Wahhabi strain of Islam that underlines violent Sunni jihad, whether al-Qaeda's brand or ISIS. Oil-addicted U.S. presidents, he writes, have long chosen to ignore this issue, but now Obama must start, quote, dialing up the pressure on the oil sheiks to douse the fire of religious zealotry that they have stoked around the world for years, end quote. That's in the December 7th issue of Time, and the subject I'll be exploring at 20 minutes past the hour with my guest, Rania Masri. Turkey presents a different problem, being that it is a member of NATO, which is President Recep Erdogan no doubt considered when he had one of his U.S.-provided F-16s shoot down a Russian fighter yesterday over what he claimed was Turkish territory. Should Russia respond in kind and attack Turkey in any way, Erdogan can call upon his fellow members of NATO to come to his aid, including the U.S., and then we might have an all-out war. Turkey has contributed nothing to the war on ISIS. On the contrary, it has allowed Sunni fighters from all across the Middle East, North Africa, and Chechnya to come across its borders to join ISIS and other jihadist groups that have been trying to oust the al-Assad government. Also, it seems clear that Turkey has facilitated ISIS's sales of Syrian oil that it has used to finance its military actions in both Syria and Iraq. Moreover, it has used F-16s provided by Washington, intended for the bombing of ISIS, to attack Kurdish forces in Iraq. None of what I have said about the Saudis or Turkey is a secret, and Robert Kagan and the neocons who used to criticize the oil sheikdoms know it as well, as I am sure it is Hillary Clinton. What has rendered them silent is both their animosity to the Assad regime and their realization that their favorite country and its leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, is now in bed with the Saudis. If Obama is lacking courage about anything, it's not publicly calling out the Saudis and the Turks, as well as Qatar, for their role in promoting what the media pundits, who also don't talk about it, refer to as Islamic terrorism. Before he arrived in Washington to meet President Obama, French President Francois Hollande was pushing for a grand coalition to defeat ISIS and the U.S. and Russia to join forces in a united fight. Russian President Vladimir Putin welcomed Hollande's proposal, saying that such an alliance is what Moscow had been advocating for months. Putin even ordered his naval forces to begin liaising with the French aircraft carrier Charles de Gaulle to coordinate aerial bombing operations in Syria against ISIS. Well, it was apparent from listening to the presentations by Obama and Hollande after their meeting yesterday that such an alliance was no longer on Hollande's agenda. He is due to meet with Putin in Moscow tomorrow, so it will be interesting to see what he has to say there. A different approach to ISIS comes from Israel, which has been providing hospital care to jihadist fighters wounded on the Golan front. Speaking on Israeli radio, Shabti Shabbat, a former chief of Mossad, said the international coalition fighting ISIS must, quote, stop talking and start doing. With this enemy, he said, we have to push aside arguments on law, morality, and comparisons of security and the rights of the individual. That means to do what they did in World War II to Dresden. They wiped it off the map. That is what has to be done to all the territorial enclaves that ISIS is holding, end quote. Unmentioned within thousands of deaths of civilians in Dresden, that it was not a military target, and that Israel has not lifted a finger to fight ISIS. Well, briefly, Haaretz reports that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is demanding that the U.S. administration accept construction in the large settlement blocks in the West Bank in return for a yet-to-be-announced package of measures that Israel would implement in the West Bank. That's on top of the $50 billion in arms he is demanding over a 10-year period. Well, at the same time, his cabinet has approved five new Jewish settlements in the largely Bedouin Negev, two of them to be built on top of what are currently Bedouin villages. Netanyahu and other Israeli officials are upset with the decision by the European Union last week to require that consumer products from West Bank Jewish settlements carry labels noting their origin in the Israeli settlements rather than made in Israel. They're also complaining that the world hasn't shown the same sympathy for the handful of Israelis killed by Palestinians as they have for those killed in the attacks in Paris, with Netanyahu actually saying, "We are not to blame for the terrorism directed against us, just as the French aren't to blame for the terrorism against them." Regarding what's happening in Israel, I say, oh yeah? Well, finally, Netanyahu, his fellow Israelis, and the leaders of the American Jewish community welcomed the release from prison last week of convicted Jewish-American spy Jonathan Pollard, who had served 30 years in prison for abusing his position as a U.S. Naval Intelligence Officer to provide Israel with what Eitan Haber, a former intelligence advisor Yitzhak Rabin, described as, quote, insane amounts of first-class high-quality information, end quote. Referring to arguments that Pollard spying on an ally was not such a great crime and that the U.S. should have provided the information to Israel anyway, Haber commented, "Friendly espionage? Our claim that Pollard spied for a friendly state and ally is ridiculous and absurd. For any intelligence service anywhere in the world, the exposure of any intelligence information means that the information is lost as if it were published at the start of every news edition." This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.